You're listening to the cycling podcast Femina, in association with Rafa, the fastest clothing in the world tour, the home of cycling with character. Ride and watch with Rafa in 2019 as they partner EF Education First and Canyon SRAM.
Hello, my name's Richard Moore. I'm with Rose Manley.
Hello, Richard.
Hello, Rose. And Orla Shinawee.
Hello, both.
Hello. How are you?
Hello. Are you shouting because I'm far away, Richard?
Didn't know I was shouting.
I'm just shouting? More enthusiastic than usual. It's a big hello. It's usually what I give.
It's what you're trying to pep yourself up because it's early, Rich. Isn't that what it is?
It is a bit early.
That's what I feel like.
It is a bit early.
Have you not had your coffees yet, guys? It's an hour later here, you see.
Yeah. We're early on a Wednesday morning in March. This is the March episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina. And we're well into the racing, aren't we? Lots of racing going on. What have we got in this week's month's episode, Orla?
Yeah, you asked me that and I've got to open the page now because you sent me through what we're doing. Sorry, I still have a newborn.
Just testing.
We have this month my racing roundup and we'll have a little bit of an interview in the middle of that. We then will be chatting to Jip van den Bos, who is the Dutch Bowls Dolmans rider who secured her first professional win. We'll have a little chat about how Bowls are doing up against the newly formed Trek Segafredo. You did an interview with the director of an incredibly powerful film, didn't you, on Afghan women cycling.
Something a bit different. Yeah, Sarah Menzies, American director, film director, and this film has just been released, so you can watch it. It's been a long time in the making. A friend of mine, Jenny Nichols, has been involved in making that as well, and it's something a bit different, but it's a very, as you say, powerful story, Orla, and so we'll talk about that a bit later on, yes.
We'll also be covering the tragic news of Kelly Catlin, the young American rider who died. We'll be chatting about her a little bit as well.
We will, and we'll have a tribute to her from Andy Sparks, who was her coach at USA Cycling when they won a silver medal in the team pursuit in Rio, and he was quite close to Kelly. He wrote a very powerful and beautiful tribute on Facebook, and I asked him if he wouldn't mind recording himself reading that, and so he's done that and sent it over, and we'll hear that right at the end of this month's episode. But do you want to crack on with your news roundup, please, Orla? And we're gonna copy the other cycling podcast.
We'll take it and improve it, Richard. We're not copying.
We're going to do a bit of a free-flowing jazz style news roundup. We're going to chip in, aren't we? Save Orla's voice.
We're going to try.
I mean, it wasn't quite poetry, but who could ever forget your daily stage updates, which I've forgotten what we called them from the women's tour, when you wove in all these kind of local themes and
Radiohead
cultural references.
And
it was very impressive, Orla.
Well, I was quite impressed with myself, I have to say. I was thinking of doing that and bringing that into every news roundup, and then I thought, I've got two children and a full-time job, so maybe not. So instead, we'll do free-flow jazz in verbal form.
Go for it.
Right, let's crack on. So we're going to start with the track worlds in Poland and the team pursuit, the Australian quartet of Annette Edmondson, Ashley and Kudinoff, Georgia Baker and Amy Kuehr regained the world title, which they held back in 2015. They won in the final over, I don't know if you saw the medal ceremony in particular, a very disappointed GB who were runners up for a second year in a row. They haven't won now since 2014 when they were on that 4-year winning streak. New Zealand in third. Team sprint went to Australia as well, with Russia second, Germany third. The individual pursuit was another gold for Australia's Ashley and Kudinoff. Lisa Brenner in second and Lisa Klein in third, both for Germany. In the scratch, Eleanor Barker beats defending champion Kirsten Wild into silver, with Julian Dora in third. The Omnium was interesting. We had Kirsten Wild successfully defending her title there, beating Letizia Paternoster by 2 points, Jennifer Valenti of the USA in third. And what was interesting about this from a GB perspective, though, no Laura Kenny in this event. The two-time Olympic champion withdrew beforehand, saying that she didn't have the form during the week of competition, and she couldn't didn't explain why. So Katie Archibald stepped in her place. But I say that she withdrew, very obviously from her statement, she was withdrawn. She seemed to take it with good grace, but Team GB obviously decided that they had a better chance with Archibald, who had won it 2 years ago. But not a great competition for her. She crashed in the points race, finished seventh. She was then worried she would lose her place in the Madison, where she was defending champion. She didn't lose her place, but she didn't manage to defend that title either. But a bit of a shake-up at Team GB there. It's looked so solid for so many years on the track.
We heard from Katie Archibald, of course, last month, in the episode last month, where she was talking about the World Championships and about the Omnium being Laura Kenny's event and very hard to remove her from that spot. Well, as you say, Orla, she had an opportunity there, and it maybe came upon her without enough preparation or without having the right form for it. I don't know, but it does open things up a bit, doesn't it? Very unusual for Laura Kenny not to be in form. She's been so consistent over the years.
And we're so close to Tokyo now.
So reliable. Yeah. Well. So yeah, big shake up at GB, and who knows what that will mean for next year and Tokyo.
Yeah, and Archibald will be gutted about that. She was devastated. I think she was kicking herself over her lost opportunity there. In the Madison, though, it was Kirsten Wild and Amy Peters of the Netherlands who took the win. And that makes Kirsten Wild a six-time world champion. Australia's Georgia Baker and Amy Cure second, and Denmark's Amelie Didriksen and Julie Leith in third, with Archibald riding with Nia Evans, finishing only in fourth. So, yeah, disappointing worlds for Archibald. Time trial, Daria Shmaleva of Russia took the win there. In the sprint, YC Lee took her first gold in 6 years, beating Stephanie Morton of Australia in the sprint finals. She won the Kieran as well, and the points race went to your cousin, of course, Rose, Alexandra Manley of Australia. My compatriot in second, with Lydia Boylan, took the biggest result of her career for Ireland. So we did well in the points, didn't we? And Kirsten Wild of the Netherlands in third. So that was your track onto the road. Setmana Ciclista Valenciana then. Two stage wins for Lotto Lapiso of Trek Segafredo, and one for her teammate Ruth Winder. So three stages for the new Trek team there. And a stage win for Cara Koppenberg. She won the Queen stage and the overall for the newly bolstered WNT Rotor Pro Cycling team. Second overall for Soria Paladin of Ali Cipollini, and third for Ashley Milman-Passio. Then on to Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. And the former world champion Chantal Black won by over a minute over Team Virtue Cycling's Marta Bastianelli, of course another former world champion, with the young Dutch rider Black's teammate Yip van den Bos, who I mentioned at the top of the episode, finishing in third. Now, you will have noticed this, boys and girls, that the race attracted attention for a whole other reason. I feel like we should have a klaxon any time that we mention the speed of women's racing compared to men's racing and how...
Is that quite good?
Thank you, Rose. No. That was very good. I liked it. So, right, let's do it again. Let's do it again, Rose. So, this race attracted attention for a whole other reason.
That was
beautiful.
quite painful.
Because... Yeah, you're right beside it, Richard. Yes, because lots of headlines and mirth around the world, it's fair to say, because the women's race had to be stopped when Swiss rider Nicole Hanselmann launched a solo breakaway, gained a lead of almost 2 minutes, and almost caught up with the men's race in front. So lots of people saying, of course, this is evidence that the women are at least as strong as the men. Women's racing is just as good as the men, as if we base it all on speed. Nicole said on her Facebook afterwards that she wasn't sure if the women were too fast or the men were too slow, but we think it probably was a logistical error really on the part of the organisers. The race book had the fastest time of the women just 10 minutes behind the slowest time of the men, so it didn't give much leeway really, did it? Didn't give much room for manoeuvre. But we have an interview with Nicole Hanselmann, don't we? We can hear from her now, can we?
Well, let's just... Yeah, she spoke to Lionel Burney after the race. I mean, Lionel explained as well in our arrival podcast, the cycling podcast...
What are you doing?
You know, that it was almost an impossible situation for the organisers, who he felt were trying to do the right thing, integrating as much as possible men's and women's races on public roads and allowing also for fans to move around those roads. Very, very difficult. And the only real solution in the event of Hanselmann catching up with the the men's peloton was to stop the women for a bit. And this does happen in road races from time to time. Races do get stopped and restarted. And there was obviously a bit of controversy around this and the way it was reported. But the riders themselves seemed quite accepting of it and got on with the racing. And Lionel spoke to Nicole Hanselman after the race. Here's her view of how things unfolded on the day.
I attacked after 7K and I got quite fast the gap on the women's peloton, and after maybe 30Ks alone I catched up with the convoy of the men's race. So the organization chose to neutralize the women's race, which is okay for the decision because of safety reasons it was not possible to go through or get the convoy somewhere else. So we stopped for maybe around 10 minutes and then we restarted the race with the same gap as before the neutralization.
So when you were closing on the race in front, you obviously knew you were catching up with the back of the men's convoy?
So actually I was wondering because I suddenly had more than the normal race cars in front of me, more police cars, the ambulances and stuff, and I didn't thought that I'm that close to the men's because I never thought about it. It was just I was wondering maybe they had a big crash or something, so the convoy got stuck a bit, but yeah.
Did the race director or a commissar say, oh, that's the men's race, we're going to have to stop? How did they communicate it to you?
Yeah, they called me forward next to the commissar's car and they told me that we are too close to the men's race and they think of a neutralisation.
Obviously, some people are asking why wouldn't they stop the men's race to let the women's race pass. Was that something that you even thought was possible?
I think the problem was it was quite early on the race and we still have 90Ks to go with no gravel section or a cobblestone section or climbs. And the courses will split up after maybe 10 or 15 Ks later. So it's like the man goes straight and we go right or something like that. And when you know the course, it's like we will enter the cobblestone section in maybe 5 Ks after the neutralization. And it's a road where one car can pass, but it's not possible to pass any cars or something. And for me, it is like it is, though.
So Nicole Hanselman then finishing 74th in the end. Chantal Black, as I say, took Newsblad. And a day later, Marta Bastianelli went one better and took the win at Omloop Van Het Hageland, winning the sprint from a reduced bunch over Lotto Lopisto of Trek Segafredo and Leah Kirchman of Sunweb. I would say Trek will be disappointed with that one. They rode a very aggressive race. Ellen Van Dijk helping control the race in the last 10 kilometres. And Lopisto, you would have said, was the strongest sprinter on paper of all of those left. But Bastianelli just rode a very clever sprint and she managed to edge Lopisto out to a slower sprint line, took the win. A brilliant start to her season. Then Lusamine de Dam was, as I said, a first pro win for the young Dutch rider Jip van den Bos, who finished on the podium already in Newsblad. We have an interview with her coming up. She's been plagued by injury for the past few years. We'll hear a little bit about that. And Daniela Gass of Germany came second. Demi de Jong, another Dutch rider of Lotto Soudal, in third. And all of that really was a bit of a warm-up for the first World Tour race of the year. Strade Bianche! A remarkable win. It's the episode of the Klaxons, isn't it? We have to cheer up March somehow.
We have to get some proper sound effects next time, maybe.
Yeah, let's see if the budget can extend to that.
See if you can steal it from the rival podcast. They've got loads of Wonga. Anyway, a remarkable win for Annemiek van Vleuten, racing for only the second time since breaking her knee at the World Championships last year. She'd had only 10 weeks of training before this. She'd said herself that it was possibly too early, but she won her first Spring Classic since 2011, celebrated with pizza, as you do. I say she's only had 10 weeks of training, but I don't know if you noticed, 9 days of those were on a camp through Portugal to Andalucía with the men's Mitchelton Scott. Mitchelton Scott squad. I like Mitchelton Scott. Mitchelton Scott squad. So she was there with the Yates brothers, Mikael Nieve, lots of others, climbing their way through Southern Europe. She's been back in Tenerife as well, where I think she is again right now. So anyone hoping for the World Time Trial Champion to ease off this year, lose some of the air, edge. I'm afraid they're going to be sorely disappointed. She soloed her way to the line after attacking on the penultimate section of gravel. A noteworthy second for five-time world champion mountain biker Annika Langvat of Bols d'Almonds. She finished second, with Cassia Nieuwiedoma in third. Now, I don't know if you noticed some of the news stories around Strade Bianche, but just a quick mention for the ongoing disparity in prize money between the men's and the women's races, because Julian Alaphilippe had €16,000 to share with his teammates after winning Strade Bianche, with a total prize pot of €40,000. Annemiek took home how much? €16,000 compared with...
Did she get €420? With a prize pot of 2,000, something like that.
€2,256 Annemiek got, with a total prize pot of just over 10,000. But Maro Venny, the race organiser, said, well, you know what, it's double last year, so we're getting better. So I guess you've got to take...
But that's mad, isn't it? Because the viewing, I think, was huge for Strade Bianche, for the women. And again, the women were going too fast, weren't they? That when Eurosport, they were going to have an hour of coverage at the end, but it ended up being about 35 minutes because the women were going much faster.
Less than that, I think it was 15 kilometres. Again, there's only so much.
They're not paid by the hour.
They upped their hourly rate at least by going very quickly. When the broadcasters have, you can only plan it so far, and when they go that quickly, it can mean that we end up seeing less of it, unfortunately.
We did see the winning move, which was good. I would like to have seen how that...
It would have been nice to have seen a
amazing break. There was a break that was just full of, I think I counted
hitters,
like six world champions across different disciplines or something ridiculous. So I don't think we got to see how that formed, but we did at least see the winning move, which is a relief, I guess.
Back to the news roundup and what we mentioned already, the news that has saddened everyone in cycling and well beyond: the death of the young American rider Kelly Catlin, the Olympic silver medalist, three-time Team Pursuit world champion, has died after taking her own life while at university in Stanford. Kelly was a fraternal triplet. She was just 23 years old. Her list of accomplishments already was simply astounding. A fluent Chinese speaker, wonderful violinist, we heard her play on the podcast, a biomedical engineering graduate who was studying, as I say, at Stanford in computational and mathematical engineering. We did feature Kelly in one of our first episodes of the podcast, and Richard, I think it's fair to say we were both in absolute awe of her. She was, by all accounts, an exceptional young lady. Just tragic news. And as you say, we will hear a tribute to Kelly at the end of the episode.
A community around the world. Stories and films with the most compelling characters. The world's finest apparel. Explore the world of cycling with Rafa.
Thank you very much to our headline sponsor, Rafa. Rafa just launched Rafa Custom, a design tool that's powerful and intuitive and will help you design your own clothing. Have a go. Go to rafa.cc, and Rose and Orla, I'm sure you will have a go at designing your own Rafa jerseys.
We should set up our own team, Orla. We have matching jerseys.
We should. Yeah, let's do it.
Who'd be the designer?
It would be one of those things that we both leave to the other person to do and then quickly mock it up on the morning.
Well, except I've got a lot of time where I'm just sitting on my backside at the moment. So you could be out riding
the miles
your bike, Rose, and I could be designing while I'm feeding my baby.
You could even have a little, lactic patches for Orla.
Yeah. Do you know what, actually? I could just design it with milk all over it already.
If you did like a camo pattern, then that would work, wouldn't it? Cover it up.
Yeah, exactly. No,
not sure this is what Rafa have in mind.
It was fresh.
There are lots of very, very nice designs and colours available there.
Frankly,
visit rafa.cc to have a go. But thanks for the suggestions there, Rose and Orla. That's fantastic. Sorry, Rafa. Hopefully
at least they're not going to be panicked about us.
Hopefully they'll still
over there.
Well, true. Yeah, hopefully they'll still be our headline sponsor next month. Anyway, we heard a comprehensive racing roundup there, Orla. Strade Bianche was the big one, really, wasn't it? Although we're going to hear from Jip van den Bosch soon and her team, Bulls Dolmans, has been quite impressive this year. And I guess it's the team that nobody was really talking about because they've been so dominant and we expected a real challenge. And they started the season pretty strongly. But it was Annemiek van Vleuten from Mitchelton Scott who won Strade Bianche. And, well, it was quite a surprise, I think, to see her back to full fitness so soon. But also, just the way that she rode away from everybody and considering some of the riders left behind. And, you know, Bulls Dolmans had two behind. Anna van der Breggen was there. CCC had two as well. Ashley Moulman-Passio, Marion Vos. And there was no organised chase. Anna van der Breggen did look to be chasing on her own for quite a bit, but really made no inroads at all into van Vleuten. So it was a combination of van Vleuten's strength and a little bit of a lack of cooperation behind. I don't know with CCC whether, you know, Moulman-Passio and Vos were both unwilling to maybe sacrifice themselves for the other. I'm not sure what was going on there. Maybe they weren't on a good day. Who knows? It's a tough race, and it's a race where it's difficult to organise any kind of chase anyway, but with only two riders, perhaps impossible. But it's quite surprising to see the ease with which van Vleuten rode off, I thought.
Yeah, it's a bad sign for CCC when Vos and Moulman finish next to each other somewhere, you know, in the lower end of the top 10. Like, that's kind of, that gives you a bit of an indication of they obviously weren't playing as a team there.
The trouble is, though, it needed two or three strong riders to try and bring back van Vleuten. I mean, van der Breggen on her own wasn't making any impact. If one of the CCC riders, Vos or Moulman-Passio, had gone to the front to chase, would they not have just been left to do that by the other teams? I mean, who would have helped them? And then what would have been the point? Because the chances of bringing back van Vleuten, I mean, they seem to know behind that they weren't going to bring her back. And so there was a sort of sense of resignation in that chasing group, it looked like.
They looked like they were fighting for the podium reasonably early on, weren't they, after van Vleuten went with such power that Vos, I think, just about grabbed onto her wheel and Nivea Doma behind. But then when Vos faltered, and I think Nivea Doma probably had something more to give, that kind of kind of blocked Cassia from getting up to Annemiek, and then Annemiek was just off at that point.
The white flag was raised on the white roads of Tuscany.
Oh, you should have said that in the freestyle jazz bit.
Oh, beautiful.
Yeah.
I asked for poetry. There you go. Boom. Should we just stop now? It's not going to get better than that. But as you say, you know, it's a bad sign for CCC. It's a bad sign for everyone, really, isn't it? That van Vleuten can start her season so phenomenally strongly and looking, when she made that move, as you say, everyone else seemed resigned. She looked unbeatable. And she just seems to be having the time of her life. She seems to have struck upon what her winning formula is, whatever that is. And it's in a combination of ridiculously difficult training, you know, when she goes by herself to Tenerife, and this recent training camp with the Mitchelton squat guys. You know, that's her training with the Yates brothers, you know, because she couldn't compete down under, so she's using that instead of early season competition, which is not a bad substitute at all. And I just see over here, she's fairly prolific really on Dutch TV and Dutch media. She really enjoys that side of it as well. You know, she enjoys the limelight and she's comfortable with it. And she just seems to have completely hit her stride. And I think she's just going to be so difficult to beat. I mean, it is silly to say that so early in the season, but just 10 weeks of training after breaking her knee, and that's the kind of performance she puts in. The rest of the riders are going to be quite scared, I would say.
Absolutely, yeah. I think we should also give mention to Annika Langvad, who's the who came second, and a lot of people who just watch road cycling. I mean, I watch road cycling. I don't know anything about mountain biking, but won't have come across Annika before. She's 34. I think she's a five-time world champion in marathon. This is me reading from my notes now because I don't understand it. But marathon, cross country.
I think she might even be older.
I
don't think she's five times in the one mountain bike discipline. I think it's four in one and one in the other or something.
I think it's in marathon cross country and one in cross country, normal cross country, which is a bit, you know, is a bit shorter. But yes, you know, this Strade Bianche is the kind of race that would really suit a mountain biker, especially someone who is an endurance mountain biker like her, because my understanding is on marathon cross country, you're doing up to 160 kilometres of mountainous terrain, that in the same way as road cycling is, you know, going from A to B isn't just kind of doing, it isn't a circuit race. So I think this was definitely the race for her, and it was amazing that that's another weapon in Bols Dolman's artillery. I mean,
that was what was quite impressive, to see Van der Breggen, the world champion. Clearly the Bols Dolman's game plan was to support her, and she's 35 in just over a week, by the way, so I was almost right.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, I'll let you have that, Richard.
Anyway, yeah, digging myself out of a hole there. But it was quite impressive to see that team, clearly she was the protected rider, despite the fact that the rider required to sacrifice herself was the world champion, Anna van der Breggen. And I think it highlighted or emphasised that Bols Dolman is still, they're a well-organised team with riders that we don't necessarily know an awful lot about, but, you know, given the support on the day, can perform, as Van den Bos did to win Samin. Chantal Black won Het Nieuwsblad. They've been impressive in terms of how they've started the season, with, you know, three different riders performing really well, and Van der Breggen still to show her best. Now, you met with the Samin winner, didn't you, Orla Yip Van den Bos? She is a neighbour of yours, I believe.
She is a neighbour of mine now, yes. She lives just outside Amsterdam in the most pretty little place called Zaanseschans. If you're ever over in Amsterdam and you want to see something that looks so typically almost theme park Dutch, it is eye-wateringly pretty. I loved it. Windmills, they've got like stroopwafel factories and cheese factories and all the rest of it. It's lovely. But yes, I didn't go there for the cheese or the stroopwafels. I went to see Yip Van den Bos. And that was one of the things that we chatted about, really, was how Bols managed to marry all of those ambitions so successfully, and all of that talent, and managed to, from the outset at least, keep those egos in check and get everybody working for each other. But Yip herself is a real talent to watch out for. This is her third year at Bols. She's been plagued by injury for the last couple of years. 2 years ago, she broke her arm in 8 places in training the week before the Nationals. The next year, on the same week, she broke her pelvis. So yes, that happened on the same week each year. So yeah, she said to Danny Stam that she would be taking it easy this year and the week before the Nationals. But she also crashed at the Women's Tour last year. So she's had an horrific time with injuries. And this is her coming into form at last and in some style. So yeah, she won Le Samin, but also finishing on the podium in Nieuwsblad. So a fantastic start to 2019 for her. And I went along to her home, her pretty home in Zaanseschans, to ask her about her form and about Bols Dolman's. So first of all, this season in terms of results, podium at Nieuwsblad, I mean, that must have been quite a day for you, was it?
Yeah, it was. It was also quite a surprise, because I was being active from the beginning, pretty active in the race, I think. I just had a good day and I helped the other girls, like Chantal and Anna, were there in the first group. My group came back and I had a good sprint. Yeah, it was quite a surprise, actually.
And I read that Danny Stam said on the morning of Le Samin that this was your day. Why did he think that the time had come for you to be able to take the leadership role within the team in that race?
Actually, Danny joins us a lot of time on training camp, so he rides also with us. And he was already like giving me a lot of confidence and saying, like, I think you really made like progress this winter and you look strong and you ride good. So he was already giving me a lot of confidence. Of course, he saw me riding in Nieuwsblad, so I think that I did a good ride there. It's not a World Tour race. It's like where the other girls are also really, really, really want to win. And I think he just said, like, this is it's a race that suits me. And it's also a good opportunity because, yeah, you're like, the form is good and the other girls are, they're okay with you taking your...
taking the win. So the other guys on the team, you mean?
Yeah, I mean like taking your chance. I think he just was thinking that I was strong enough for it, and it was a race that suited me.
So talk me through the race itself then, talk me through the win. It was quite an impressive one, a long solo effort.
Yeah, it was, I think from the beginning it was hectic. Like, it's a short race, it was a bit more than 100k. We tried to do a lot of echelons, but which didn't really work. But on the local lap, it broke every time after some cobbles. There were a lot of attacks, and we were like, with the team, we were also pretty active, I think, with attacking. We found out pretty quick that when Chantal was going with the group, like the peloton would directly be on it. And when I was in the group, I got a little space. So at some point, I was just in the break, which got a lot of space because all the teams were in, and I was feeling really good at the moment. But I was a bit in doubt if I should like wait for a sprint or if I should like attack. And then I had a little chat with Danny in the car, and he said, yeah, I think it's, if you feel good enough, it's safer to try. He was giving me pretty good advice in like where I should try it, because I was a bit in doubt where I should try it. So that was really good that I had the chat with him, I think. And then I just tried, and when I was gone, I just thought, okay, now I have to do it like on the Chantal and Anna's way, just right to the finish as hard as I can.
And you say that the other guys were happy that you had your chance again on that day. How does it work amongst Bulls Dolmans? How does that amount of talent, the breadth and depth of talent and potential winners on that team, how are they managed together?
What makes it easier to work for each other is that you also get your own chance. Like also for me now that I won Samin, also before that I won, I would love to, like, to work for the other girls. But because you also know that they, like, you give it to each other, right? Like you help each other. It's not always one way. It's not that I always write for somebody in front and the other person never does that for me. And I think that makes it easier that you like to give it to each other or something. I think everybody is also, like, tries to be honest if you have a good day or not. Like sometimes you just don't have a good day, and then we still have like five other girls which are strong, so somebody else has to take the chance then.
Is that expressly said then, that this is the ethos of the team, that each of you gets your chance at whatever given race depending on who's got the form? Is that something that Danny instills amongst you so that you know that it's an underlying mentality, I guess, amongst the team?
Actually, it is, I think. I remember, I don't know if it was this year or another year, that we had a meeting in like January or something about like our goals, or it was December maybe, I don't know. And a goal of the team is also like that everybody takes a win that year. So yeah, I think it's like our ethos a bit.
Then what about the races that everybody wants to win? I mean, not everybody can get the chance in those days.
I think you also have to be honest. Like, there is, of course, some girls who have, like, a goal in a year. So, like, if you really want to win Nieuwsblad, like, you should also say it before the race, because everybody goes in with a different form, like, and other expectations. But if there are four girls who have the same race as a real goal, yeah, that's quite hard. So we have to know from each other. So we do it also. Like, in December, we tell each other, okay, this year I have this and this race, which is really important for me. And yeah, if there's more girls doing this at the same race, then you should discuss, like, those girls should have like a talk before or something.
And so can you arrive at the start line and decide, well, okay, Anna van der Bergen and Chantal Black both want to go for this race today, let's see how it pans out on the road? Does that also happen?
Yeah, I think we always race like this. We never say, okay, we go for this girl. We always go for, like, okay, this girl has the goal, but like our strength is that we have the number. So we cannot race really for one person, because like our strength is the number. So if one girl attacks and the other girl goes over and that girl stays away, yeah, that girl is going to win. Like, yeah, you cannot really decided it before, I think.
And that makes it so difficult to race against as well, because all the other teams know that you've got a plan B, a plan C, sometimes a plan D as well. I'm thinking of Trek Segafredo and how much of a noise they made coming on to the scene. I think many would have expected them to be quite dominant already, possibly at this stage of the season, and yet they're not. Bulls Dolmans are still the dominant team for now, when it's very, very, very early. We've only had one World Tour race. But how did you see their arrival on the scene? Is there much considered rivalry between the two of you from within Bulls Dolmans?
I think not really rivalry. Like, of course, they're on our radar. That, like, it's, of course, it's a strong team. That they also have the numbers, and all the girls are one by one are really strong. I think, and they actually already showed that they are strong, because in Valencia they worked really good together, and they won, I think, three stages.
Yep.
Like, the thing is also that it's a new team. Like, we are for a longer time together, so we know each other better. We know already how to race, and they are all from different teams and just new together, so that also have, like, it has to take some time, I think. I also think it's really good. Like, it's nice to have a really strong team, another strong team in the women's peloton, and it's good for women's cycling. It's nice for the races. So we just have, for us, for Bulls Dolmans, we just have to be worried about, like, our own strength and not being afraid for another team, I think.
Do you think it's easy to underestimate sometimes how long it can take for all of that team gelling to come together, be it the DSs understanding the riders understanding each other and the DSs and everything, I guess new equipment as well and new sponsors that you've got to work with and new sponsor priorities. All of those things take a long time, don't they, really, to settle down?
I think so, yeah. I cannot say it for them, but if I speak for myself, if I'm in a new team, I also have to get used to like their way of riding and all the new stuff around. So I think it takes some time, even if you're like aware of it. You can't go faster. You just have to learn, because sometimes you cannot talk in races or stuff. You just have to like feel it or know how it works, and that just takes time.
Does it matter that if any of your rivals are the female teams of a very successful male team? I'm thinking in terms of all of the learned practice that they can simply absorb, I guess, from how the men have done it so well already. Does that create a little bit of extra concern that you think, well, they'll have the advantage over us on certain things, for example?
I think in some ways, I think that works positive. But I think also like in race tactics or something, women's racing is just really different. So I think that doesn't really matter. And probably in sponsor things, it's easier. And it's maybe easier in, I think a lot of men teams have, they have bigger, their stuff around is bigger. So they maybe know more like about food or like about the... Yeah, probably there are positive things, but I don't think you have to have a men team. I think as a rider, you don't really notice. I think maybe for the stuff around, it's easier. But I think for us as riders, I don't know why it would be easier.
Chute, chute à l'arrière du peloton. Cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
The voice of Seb Piquet there reminds me to tell you that this month's episode of the Cycling Podcast Femina is sponsored by...
Harry's Razors.
Nice, Rose. Well done. Harry's Razors. Yes. Once again, it falls upon me to endorse Harry's Razors. Although somebody called Paul Pedals actually Instagrammed. I don't think it's his surname. No. Yeah, he posted on Instagram his Harry's set that he'd got thanks to the discount code that we were offering last month's Cycling Podcast Femina. Great trial deal, says Paul Pedals. Thanks to the Cycling Podcast, maybe I'll be as smooth as the buffalo.
Oh. It's interesting that you say Instagram, because this is actually true. I'm looking at you on my laptop at the moment, and usually I'm looking on my phone, and I didn't know if it was a different sort of pixelation on my screen, but it looks like you've got an Instagram filter on your face. You look so smooth. Like you've actually got the light
in real
reflecting
life,
off
that's
your
true
cheeks.
As well.
Orla, you're not contractually obliged to go quite that far with this.
But it's true. I thought it looks like you've got a filter on, but it could be my laptop is very old, so it's probably bad pixelation.
Or it could be the Harry's razors.
Or it probably is the Harry's razors.
I have
what razor. I was trying to say.
Might be more.
In preparation for this podcast. Part of my pre-podcasting ritual is to shave with my Harry's razor, and it's been over a year now of shaving my Harry's razor. Still very good. And you, as a listener to the Cycling Podcast Femina, can get a trial set for £3.95. All you have to do is go to harrys.com/cycling. What do you get with your Harry's trial set, Rose?
I mean, I can't believe that I am reading this. I can't believe I don't know it off by heart.
You probably do.
I probably do. Should I test myself? Okay, I'm closing my eyes. Weighted ergonomic handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trim blade. Am I doing okay?
Not bad.
Rich lathering shave gel and, can I remember the last one? Is it a travel blade cover?
That's correct, Rose.
Yes.
Well done. So get started shaving with Harry's today by claiming your trial set for £3.95. Support the Cycling Podcast Femina and get your trial set delivered to you, including the razor handle, the 5-blade cartridge, the foaming shave gel and the travel blade cover by going to harrys.com/cycling right now. That's harrys.com/cycling. Now, before that interlude, we heard from Jip van den Bos, a young Dutch talent, another young Dutch talent, and she does sound like a very promising prospect in a great team, obviously. And as I mentioned before, we heard from her, what's impressive about that team is that other riders are getting a chance there, clearly, and she has already had a podium and a win this year. What else can we expect from her this year, do you think?
She's focusing for the next part of the season anyway on the Dutch races. That's where she really wants to shine. But yeah, I think what's really interesting and what seems to be the key to success among Bo Stallmans, apart from obviously having so many world champions on their roster, but it's the fact that they are all given their chance. She's, I think, 22. And as I say, plagued by injury so far in Bo's, and yet she was given her chance amongst that roster. Fair enough, it was at Lusamine, it wasn't a World Tour race, but still, the fact that they all know that they will get their chance when the day is right, I think makes a massive difference. Really interesting as well, we're talking about the dominance of Bo's, but the Dutch just look so difficult to beat as a nation. If you look at the top 10 in Strade Bianche, 5 of the top 10 were Dutch riders. I mean, we're looking at what is a golden generation at the moment, but it's one that is being fed from the bottom up. It doesn't look like it's going to end anytime soon. It's very impressive.
I wish I could hear a podcast feature about the dominance of Dutch cycling. I wish that was a thing.
Funny
that existed.
You should say that, Rose. Funny you should say that. I might be working on one right now. Watch the space.
Well, are you getting a sense of why it is? Why are the Dutch women as dominant as they are? Why are there so many of them performing at that level?
What's really funny when you ask any of the Dutch riders is that not only do they not have a clue, but it's obviously for any of us, it's very difficult to step out of the environment in which you have grown up. And speaking to Yip yesterday, for example, I said, you know, is it because cycling is such a part of your culture? You know, I see kids riding on their bikes here from such a young age. And she said, oh yeah, we do, don't we? Is that not the case anywhere else? And they don't even realise that it's such a part of the fabric of their society. A huge part of it, though, has to be the visibility. You know, I mentioned that Annemiek van Vleuten, she enjoys the limelight here, but she's given a limelight to enjoy. You know, she's given a spot on television. You hear her on the radio. She's on chat shows. We don't have female cyclists really on chat shows, certainly in the UK. It's not that common in other countries either. So for younger riders coming through, they have people to aim towards. They've got a very strong competition set up here as well on weekends that, by all accounts, is growing ever stronger, and it's something that is becoming a bigger feature for young girls and a bigger possibility for young girls, and it is just growing.
Is that just cycling, or is the status of women's sport different in Holland generally?
It's quite an egalitarian society anyway. Parenting is much more shared here. It is male and female are I guess more on a level than some other countries. And women's sport is very important here. Girls here are not wrapped in cotton wool in the way that they might be in other countries. They are taught to climb on things and fall off things and pick themselves back up again. And they do a broad range of sports from a very young age. I mean, hockey is a huge case in point, where Dutch hockey, female hockey, is absolutely massive. So they are encouraged to do sport. They are not necessarily encouraged along the pretty side of things. You know, it's not a country where you see lots of young girls dressed up on a weekend. It's a much more roots upbringing, I would say, for little girls. Kids here are allowed to be kids, and that, I think, matters more for young girls than it does for young boys, because boys will always be boys. But little girls are encouraged to be little girls and to not grow up too quickly, and sport is a fun part of that. That's what I'm finding so far.
They're also encouraged to be competitive, aren't they? Because I was talking to Fabio Jakobsen, the De Koning Quickstep sprinter, a few weeks ago, and he was saying about, you know, how everyone kind of gets into cycling is they do these flat pedal races where, when you're about 5 years old or something, you know, absolutely tiny, whereas here, you know, people are still a bit wobbly on their bikes. But over there, people do these in their own villages, these flat pedal races where you're just riding a bike, not a road bike, you're not riding anything that's flashy, you don't have the kit, you're riding in jeans and t-shirts, and you have a normal bike, like a normal old Dutch style bike, and you're racing against each other, boys and girls together. And that kind of fosters a competitive nature in people and over there, and also means that it's not exclusive. Whereas I think over here, if you want to become a bike racer, even as a child, you need to have the kit, you need to have a proper bike. It's not a case of just turning up on whatever you've got and giving it a go.
Oh yeah, and it's such a democratic sport here. I mean, in terms of the competitive side of it, like I say, they're not wrapped in cotton wool. They're encouraged to kick ass, you know, and that's absolutely fine. And because every child has a bike, it's not a status symbol in any way. I mean, where I live, there's a little kiddies park just outside. You've both seen it. There's a little kiddies park in front of where we live, and there's a whole collection of bikes that belong to the park that are chained up every night. But during the day, any kid just goes and takes a bike and rides around on it, you know. and everyone has access then to a bike. And that visibility, again, is hugely important. I mean, my daughter turned four just after arriving here, and she was quite a timid little girl, really, before we came here. Within 3 weeks, literally 3 weeks, she was riding her bike without stabilisers. And I'm convinced that's because she saw all the other little kids riding their bikes and realised that it was something that was quite normal. And so that, it, you know, there's a long way, and that's what I'm trying to uncover a little bit more of, but there's a long way between that and bossing world cycling, you know, and bringing home all those race wins at the elite level. But it's a damn good place to start, that's for sure.
Just watch her near that canal.
I'll bring the tone down. You don't know, I'm going to start rapping. I'm going to start being all Anglo-Saxon. Stay away from the canal, darling.
All the canals.
Difficult
which are
to
everywhere.
Stay away from the yeah. canal.
All the canals. Well, certainly where
I am. Have you seen any of the bikes toppling into the canal yet?
Not yet, but it happens a lot.
It must do.
I've seen that in London.
They dredge a lot of bikes out of the canals every year, but they're not convinced how many of those are actually maybe stereotypical here, possibly British tourists coming over, getting drunk and chucking them in the canal. I'm not sure it's people actually riding into the canal by mistake.
The cycling podcast Femina is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport for supporting the cycling podcast Femina. And you can still get 25% off all your Science and Sport sports nutrition products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. This month's question for the Science and Sport experts comes from Neil Tiffany. Neil asks, I often wonder when I should and shouldn't use recovery products. By that I mean, when have I done enough? If it's an easy winter ride, just 10 or 20 miles, he says, or a gentle turbo session, is it still beneficial? I'm not looking to lose weight, so that isn't a concern. I just wondered if it's still worth it after easier efforts. So when should Neil use recovery products, after every ride or just after longer rides? Over to the Science and Sport expert, Ben Samuels.
It's an interesting topic, Neil, and actually recovery nutrition is a question that we get asked about a lot in general, and this applies to recovery nutrition too. The periodization of nutrients and how you're using sports nutrition products throughout your training is going to be linked to daily workloads and what you're trying to achieve in terms of training adaptations, maybe any body composition goals and different bits and pieces like that feeding in. For specifically this question and your recovery nutrition, the when you put a recovery product in, when you don't, I'd look to break it down based on what session you had. So if you've had an easy spin or a recovery type session of lower intensity or shorter duration, then your post-exercise recovery nutrition can be all achieved through a whole food approach. So a balance of carbohydrate and protein in a meal after exercise. If you've been out on the hard sessions of the week, so we're talking intervals, hill repeats, overgeared efforts, or that long weekend ride, then recovery nutrition should include a couple of different options. The first being an immediate carbohydrate protein recovery shake designed to kickstart the recovery process, then follow that up with a meal within the next 1 to 2 hours.
Well, we were talking about the Dutch cycling culture and the a culture that encourages young girls to do sport and ride bikes, and that's a neat segue to Afghanistan, which is the opposite. But before we go on to that, Ola, did I just catch you saying that you almost rode your bike into the canal while we were taking a pause there?
I waited until we stopped recording.
Ah, wonderful.
Oh yeah. In my defense, it's a huge. We've gotten rid of our cars here, so we just have bikes. And we bought a huge family cargo bike, the big electric ones. They're really cumbersome, and I was taking off uphill in the middle of. I say uphill. Obviously, we don't have hills in Amsterdam. I just mean a tiny
on a bridge. Yeah,
and I was trying to navigate through tourists. I tried to turn the bike at the last minute, which you cannot do with one of those bikes, and I almost rode it into a canal as a tourist boat was coming past, and as some mothers from my daughter's school were walking past as well. So that was a wonderful moment when I was trying to get all Dutch. But yeah. There we go.
They probably said, oh, it's typical, those British Irish tourists.
They didn't say it was typical of anybody. They said, what are you doing lying on the floor with that huge bike on top of you? I'm like, move along, nothing to see here.
didn't catch that on your Instagram feed. Anyway, I mentioned Afghanistan, and this is a little bit of a departure, but also not, because it's a film called Afghan Cycles on International Women's Day, which was, I think, the 8th of March, a few days ago. It was released to the public, so you can go to iTunes, I think Amazon, places like that, and buy it to watch. And it's well worth watching. It's been a long time in the making. We'll hear from the director, Sarah Menzies, in a moment about how it came into existence, this film, and the process that she's gone through in making it, and the twists and turns. We spoke a lot about the central character in the film, Frozan. You'll not hear that chat, because actually I realised it was all kind of spoiler alerty. What happens to her in the film is really gives the film a sort of real sense of drama. It pivots on what happens to her, and it's very moving, and I found it a really kind of absorbing, compelling watch, this film. So go and watch it if you can, Afghan Cycles. What impressed me, or what struck me about it, was just how driven these women were to not just ride bikes, but to race their bikes. You know, it follows some women who are on the national team. Just riding a bike in a lot of cases is very difficult. It's frowned upon culturally. That's putting it very mildly. There can be terrible consequences for women who ride bikes in Afghanistan. And so wanting to race them, both at home and abroad, is really a step beyond, you know, what's considered acceptable by a lot of people there. Although there are a lot of very progressive people as well who help them and support them, including their parents. So let's hear from Sarah Menzies about the film Afghan Cycles and about some of the women there. Here she is.
It brings them joy. It also gets them around without having to rely on anybody else, you know? It's pretty cool, yeah. You know, sometimes they'd say, you know, we ask them what they, you know, how far do they want to take this? And they say they want to win the Tour de France. And you realize, gosh, they kind of get it, but they also are removed just enough. They don't know that women can't ride in that, you know? I mean, I think most of them know now, but in the early days, it was sort of an interesting little snippet of like, gosh, they are dreaming big, but they're in a country, like they don't have access to all of this. Or, you know, they know about it, but they don't know all the details. When I heard about the women on bikes in Afghanistan, honestly, I thought we were going to make a short film, something under 20 minutes that was cycling-centric, with this unique backdrop of Afghanistan being the thing that kind of sets it apart from other cycling films. But I'll tell you that within an hour of landing, I knew that, you know, I was in over my head and that this was going to be a lot bigger than I originally thought it would be, just in terms of setting the scene and contextualizing what these women are doing, you know, is so courageous as well as taboo. So thus began the 5-year journey of putting together this film.
The bicycle anywhere is it's a symbol, isn't it, of freedom and independence. And
oh yeah.
So it takes on a sort of huge importance in a place like Afghanistan, especially for women. Did that become apparent to you quite early on as well?
Definitely. You know, the bicycle is very common. I mean, you see men and boys all over the country riding bikes. It's an affordable vehicle and a fun one at that. And so you see them everywhere. I think there's probably more bikes than cars in some parts of the country, and certainly parts of Kabul, just because of how accessible they are. But a woman on a bike, you know, that's unheard of in a country like that. And so I think that seeing what these women were doing for what seems very basic, you know, just the simple act of getting on a bicycle, it was pretty crazy to realize, gosh, there aren't any women doing this in the country. There really is just this handful. And then obviously looking back, I think as we got deeper into the production and I started researching it more, I honestly didn't know the role that the bicycle played in our own women's suffrage movement, definitely here in the States. But as I've looked into it, in many Western countries, it is the vehicle that gave women the freedom and independence and mobility and all of that good stuff that we have today. And so seeing those parallels was really fascinating as we were digging deeper with the women.
What's striking watching the riders that you focus on is they're not just riding their bikes. There's a sort of competitive drive there, and they're quite keen to be proper cyclists rather than to just use the bicycle in a sort of utilitarian way. They seem driven by a desire to you know, to be good and to compete, and ultimately some of them do compete.
Yeah, definitely. The national team in Kabul, our main story arc there. Most of those women do want to compete on the international stage, while there's always the thought in their mind that they just want to change the culture in Afghanistan. I'm generalizing here, but most of those characters want to be competitive cyclists. Whereas Bamiyan, when, you know, our sub story that we cut to a couple times in the film, those women out in the mountain, you know, central region of Afghanistan, that's very mountainous and spread out, you know, they just want to be able to ride a bicycle the way that the boys and men do in their community, so that they can get to school faster and run errands more efficiently. As that character Zara, our main character in Bamiyan, says, a bicycle can get you out of a bad situation faster, you know. So they're, for them, it's definitely more of the cultural shift, whereas the national team in Kabul is wanting to, you know, they have dreams of going to international races. They've gone to a few international races, which is really exciting to see. And then obviously the women that are now in France are riding more competitively, which is exciting to see.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, through the film, you meet lots of different people. And I guess sort of open Afghanistan up for the viewer a little bit. You know, we meet people who represent different schools of thought on religion and on women and cycling and all the rest of it. There's an interview with a member of the Taliban, which is pretty chilling. How did that come about? How was that arranged? And how did you feel conducting that?
Well, I'll tell you, that came about when I was not in country. A friend and colleague of ours, Travis Beard, who was doing some pickup shots for us in Kabul, he actually said, hey, my fixer has a connection to a district judge of the Taliban. Do you have any interest in interviewing him? You know, and I actually got that email while I was in remote Alaska working on a completely different film. I didn't want to lose that opportunity. And it's the thing that sticks out to a lot of people, but it's the only interview that I didn't do. But I did do it in that I sent Travis a lot of questions and said, even if you stray and, you know, follow other leads, make sure that at least these questions are getting asked. And so there is sort of a blessing there that I think if I had been in Kabul and that came up, you know, I'd like to think that I would have taken that. That's what we're doing in this work, and to have an opportunity to hear from the other side. You know, I would like to think that I would have seized that and gone for it, but I can almost bet that that man would not have taken the interview with me. And so that's something I've always wondered. He definitely didn't know that it was this American woman, you know, infidel, writing in these questions and using Travis as the way to ask them. And even that interview, I go back and forth on whether or not we should have even included it. You know, I didn't want to give him a platform. A lot of it, to be honest, when you read through the translation of it, it just feels like propaganda for the Taliban. You know, that for him, this was a platform to be able to share their message. And so we had to be really choosy about what we included so it didn't feel like we were giving them that platform, but also addressing what not just women on bicycles are up against, but what everyday Afghans just going to work are up against, you know, and just that constant threat.
I mean, you've got, you know, you obviously met other hardliners in there, but what's also striking is we also meet men, not just women, but men who are quite progressive and open. And the coach in particular was a really warm and avuncular presence in it, you felt. And it helps to, I suppose, underline that it's a varied country with lots of different people and lots of different ideas. And I guess your experiences probably just emphasize that for you, did they, in that you were encountering lots of different people with lots of different viewpoints.
Oh, definitely. And I think, you know, especially the fathers of these young women and their brothers, you know, in a country like Afghanistan, they need permission from the men in their lives, which is great that they have the progressive men in their lives to say yes to this, but it obviously is still a form of oppression that they need that permission. But either way, they're lucky that they have the support of their families. Most of them do. So to hear that, I think, is really great. So when we are able to finally show it in Afghanistan, that'll be something that changes. To have the fathers see that other fathers are allowing their daughters to do this, I think, is huge. But even just pulling those layers back and showing a different side of Afghanistan than what we see in the news was so important to us. And some of my favorite scenes are those moments where, even though we hear that things are getting, are heightening and it's getting, you know, they're starting to lose that security and safety as the Taliban's hitting harder, especially by 2015. I love those moments when we can just take a little bit of a deep breath and hear from them what it's like to live in Kabul and what Kabul means to them, and be able to show this beautiful, accepting, warm, welcoming culture that is there, you know, and I hope that that changes some perspective on, well, on Afghans, but Muslim countries at large, you know, that what we hear in the news, that there are people there that are actually the victims of that violence and have a completely different way of thinking.
What I really liked about that film, as you say, it's so incredibly moving and powerful, but I loved the range of people that we got to see on the Afghan women's cycling team. You've got the girls, the athletes, who are incredibly driven and very sporty. And then at the other end of the spectrum, there's one of the athletes who is so girly. She's so endearing. She goes along and wants to get to the bike shop and wants to get a bike that's pink because pink is her favourite colour, and she's often seen riding around in pink. And her bedroom, she says it herself, looks like a 14, 15 year old girl's. You know, she's just, she likes everything that's dainty, and it's wonderful to see that contrast with her riding her bike in what is such a dangerous environment. And it really helped, I think, to humanise their story and to make their plight very human in a part of the world that we often only ever really see through the prism of news reports, and terrible news reports at that. I thought it was beautifully done.
You really do get to know a couple of the characters, Frozan in particular, and to empathise with their plight. And, you know, as said earlier, this is a little bit of a departure, this feature for this podcast. It features mainly on top-end racing, elite racing. But, you know, I think it's sobering and healthy to remind ourselves sometimes that there are parts of the world where we talk a lot about the disparity between men's and women's cycling at the elite level, but there are places where women can't even ride a bike or are discouraged from riding a bike. We had on the Explorer series an interview with Ishbel Holmes, who had spent some time in Iran riding for the Iranian national team, and it's a similar situation there. And so, you know, people like her and Frozan can really shine a light on how difficult it is in some places, unfortunately, still. Never mind for women to race and get, you know, the same prize money as men, but even just to ride a bike in the first place. So that's Afghan Cycles, the film, which is available, and you'll find it in the usual channels, iTunes and places like that. Do go and watch it. We mentioned at the start the very sad news about Kelly Catlin, and we had her on the podcast a couple of years ago, just after she won her silver medal at the Rio Olympics. We thought we'd play a little bit of that interview again by way of a tribute to her. As you said, Orla, a real high achiever. She was a good footballer as well before she became a cyclist, and obviously, you know, a high achieving student. Academic, a fluent Chinese speaker, a mathematician, an artist, a good writer. She wrote a very poignant blog for Velo News just a week or so before she died, talking about the kind of pressure that she was under. And a lot of people reading into that blog, you know, the signs that she was in trouble. I think it's kind of dangerous to do that too much, because such an individual thing that it's dangerous to try and imagine that we can fully understand. And I think only the person fully understands their predicament. It's so complex that it's difficult and dangerous, I think, to read something that somebody's written in a blog and assume that the answer lay there and that other people have let her down, because unfortunately the next step often is to look for people to blame or things to blame, whether that be academia or elite sport or coaches or parents or friends who have somehow failed in not reading the signs. And I, you know, that left me feeling a little bit uncomfortable. It's such a tragic, sad thing to have happened to somebody with so much talent and so much potential, that we thought at the end of this month's episode we would try and pay a little tribute to her and hear a little bit from that interview, and also hear her old coach Andy Sparks, who ran the national team when she was part of that in Rio, read out his tribute. So before we hear a little bit from that interview with Kelly from the winter of 2016, and we'll hear a little bit of her violin playing as well, because she was kind enough to send an audio file with her playing the violin, which she was very reluctant to do. She was seemed very modest and reluctant to showcase her talent for violin on the podcast, but I persuaded her to do so, and that was a nice feature as well. Before we hear that and Andy Sparks, we'll say our cheerios. Thank you very much, Rose.
Thank you, Richard. Thanks, Orla.
Thank you, Orla.
Thank you very much. And just before we hear that, I would like to read out, if anyone is feeling depressed, suicidal in any way, then you can find the International Suicide Helplines at www.befrienders.org. There are people out there who are trained to help. They want to help, and you can get help.
Well, first of all, let's start with Rio and the Olympic Games, because obviously you were part of a really thrilling team pursuit final. Now, it was a very young team that you were part of, with the exception, obviously, of Sarah Hammer, your kind of experienced teammate. But tell me about the last sort of 12, 15 months leading up to that, because, you know, I think I've read an interview where you said sort of 18 months ago it was not really on your radar, and you know, it was something that happened quite dramatically. So tell me just about that journey from it being a possibility to you being in Rio and in the final.
Yeah, it was quite an interesting journey. So yeah, probably about 18, 19 months ago, I was a road rider only. I was riding national level events, just kind of an amateur level rider. And I was picked up by the USA Cycling Talent ID Camp, and I attended that, and that was the first time I rode on the track in late 2014. And then apparently I did well enough, and a few months later they invited me to be a resident at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. That was, I believe, January 2015. So that was the first time I ever rode a track.
Wow.
And I was, yeah, I was told at that point that, I mean, as a resident in an Olympic Training Center, you feel a sense of possibility that you could be on the Olympic team, but it was by no means guaranteed. And from there, we already had Ruth, who's a very, very experienced rider as well, and Jennifer Valente, also has lots of experience on the track. So it was just a matter of, like, collecting riders from different areas until about 12 months out is when we finally had our team together, our team of five riders.
Wow. And then from there, you went, obviously, to the World Championships in London and came home with a gold medal. What was that experience like?
That was very odd because, as a lot of people probably noticed, we really weren't expecting that. In the World Cups leading up to the World Championships, we had varying performances. We were improving, but we were trying out new tactics, basically, new rider combinations, and that worked out fairly well. And then, for some reason, we just hit on something that worked really well at the World Championships and went much faster than we'd ever gone before. So I would say it was surprising more than anything else. It wasn't until after the race that we were like, oh yeah, we rode faster than a 4:16. That was really odd.
Mm. I mean, it's the ultimate team event, obviously. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier, you've got Sarah Hammer there, who's very experienced, and you've got Andy Sparks, who's been a coach for a long time. What's the secret? Is Andy a big factor in that? You've got some very talented young riders like yourself as well. What's the magic in that team? What's the magic formula?
That's a good question. As you mentioned, being a team event, obviously the group chemistry is very important. I mean, so many sports say that, but I would say in particular with such a small group of riders, it's very important. And also the relationship between the riders and the director. It took a while to get the chemistry right, to be kind of united behind one goal. But actually, it was World Championships that I think that really did that. Once we had that that kind of hope there, it became much easier to settle down and be like, all right, our goal is the Olympics, and we're all going to work towards this. Andy and Sarah are also a big part of that. Sarah's very experienced. She's a very grounding presence in training and racing, which is really good. It's like having a coach as one of your own riders, which can be very helpful at times. And then Andy, of course, is experienced at high-level events and is a grounding presence in his own right.
And then Rio, you were up against a British team that, you know, that's dominated that event and track cycling for a number of years. Very, very unusual scenario, because it was almost a David and Goliath with USA unusually as David, you know, because you're a team that doesn't have the resources that the British team has, you know. And how did that feel going into that final? You must have been aware that it would take probably a world record to win it, but you know, were you thinking we can do this, we can beat this team?
To be honest, in the races, I was never really thinking about the outcome. I would think about it a few moments, like the night before the race. I was like, oh, goodness gracious, it's the Olympics. But other than that, you have track is nice in that you have so many little tasks to focus on in the hours and minutes up to leading up to a race. So in some ways, your mind is completely occupied, which is very helpful because you can't be distracted. So for me, it was all about, it's like, okay, this is the warm-up I'm doing. Am I on schedule? Here's my number. Here's my bike. Am I ready? And then you're on the start line and it was all over.
And so, you know, were you pleased with your silver medal? You must have been disappointed to lose the final, but to come home from Rio with a silver medal, was that something you could reflect on with real pride and satisfaction?
Yes, I would say for several reasons. First off, I never expected to be on an Olympic team, particularly for track cycling. And second of all, we still made tremendous gains over the past year or 2 years, which were really impressive. And we still showed that in the final. We did our best, too. So there's nothing you can really be upset about.
A tribute to Kelly Callan, 1995 to 2019. The first time I met Kelly was in the summer of 2014 at a women's talent ID camp held at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs. Kelly was invited because her North Star cycling team would not stop talking about this incredible young lady up there in Minnesota that we had to see and test. Anyone's first impression of Kelly is that this young lady is exceptional. And by the time that camp was over, it was me and my 74-year-old Norwegian swan ear Vigo trying to make the sell to Kelly on why she should move to Olympic Training Center and go all in for making the team for Rio in 2 years' time. For the next 2+ years, Kelly would train beside her teammates in an epic journey to go from fifth in the world to first in the world in 12 months' time and to win the first ever gold medal for the United States in the team pursuit. Training 3 to 6 hours per day, Kelly always set the standard for her teammates to follow. Kelly went on to win an Olympic silver medal with her teammates in 2016 at the Olympic Games. Other results include 3 world championship titles in the team pursuit, 2 world championship medals in the individual pursuit, countless Pan Am championship titles, and a bonus gold medal in the 2015 Pan Am Games road time trial. Of course, Kelly being Kelly, she never pursued excellence in only one category. She had the highest expectations and work ethic of anyone I've ever met. An accomplished violinist, fluent in Chinese, a degree in biomedical engineering, all packaged in a person who always put others first. Kelly also put the most amount of pressure on herself of any athlete I've worked with, and often we would have disagreements on me trying to pressure her to take on and do less. Kelly wanted to achieve perfection in everything she did, never wanted to show weakness, always wanted to make everyone proud, and first and foremost, never wanted to let anyone down. Unfortunately, Kelly was exceptional in everything she touched, except for taking care of herself. And as someone who cared about her, that was the only fault I ever saw on her. Kelly, you made us all proud. We just wish you could have taken better care of yourself. You're special to all of us, with or without the results, and we hope you know that. I was somewhat close to Kelly's family as they were trusting enough to send their 19-year-old daughter to join our Olympic Training Center resident team in order to join our epic journey. Periodically, we would go over how Kelly was doing, and Kelly often spoke of fun family adventures and the exciting things that she and her brother Colin would do when she went home. One thing is for sure, her parents did an amazing job and produced one of the most exceptional human beings that I'll meet in my lifetime. Rest in peace, Kelly.